Welcome to Social Distance Central. Wait, that's what this is now? You're on Sportsnet 650. Here's Bit Nizar and Brendan Batchelor.
Welcome to Social Distance Central, the show with a COVID name. It's not about COVID during the COVID era. I'm Vic Nizar. Brendan Batchelor continues his holiday. And so with me is Jamie Dodd. You hear him on the Scott Rintoul show. What is going on, Jamie? It's Friday in our modified work week.
Yeah, just another gray, rainy July day here in Vancouver, and it's Friday. So I don't know, a bit of a weird day, a bit of a weird week. I would love the weather to turn, but yeah, like I said, just another rainy day here.
I am dead.
It's been a long week, with the holiday in there as well, because so much has happened this week. We figured out the hub cities. Looks like those are going to get confirmed. We've coming off of the heels of the lottery and everything. We talked about the Olympics, and I did want to kind of cycle back on something because the topic of the week has been playoffs and a lottery. So I kind of want to put a whole bow on it. And I'm going to admit something to the Tankists, and I'm going to show something to the playoff people, because this is literally a lottery, right? And think of it as life. The allure of the lottery and first overall, and why that conversation is so appealing, is habitually we just relate better to money won as humans. We relate better to money won than money earned. It's easier to say, hey, I want those seven numbers and hope you get it right, because that's comfortable and we enjoy comfort. It's comfortable to imagine one day you wake up, like all your problems are gone and you get the life you wanted. It's the shortcut to fix all issues, but it doesn't negate that progress can be made in the long, arduous path. And so this whole week of discourse where it gets framed of lottery versus playoffs, tanks and success, what's best for the whole franchise in the long term and the short term? I'm going to admit something to the folks who have been pro losing to the Minnesota Wild. So you give yourself that 12.5% chance of drafting first overall, because those arguing for that, and let's specifically talk about first overall. Here's the thing I'll admit. You're not wrong. Those of you who are pro losing in the play-in round to attain first overall pick, you get Alex Lafreniere. You're not wrong, because getting him, obviously a tremendous get for the franchise. Jamie, you and I had that fun destinations conversation yesterday,
yeah.
And envisioning a scenario where Lafreniere plays with Pettersson. Obviously, it's a lot of fun. It's incredibly tantalizing to think where they could work, what they could work up on a power play, whatever. So I look at that and I say, that's money won. Like, I would love to win the lottery draw tomorrow or today, whatever it is, and set up financially. I'm good. Here's the and having that conversation between the two sides is tough, because look, it's hard to argue that a decade of Pettersson, Hughes, Lafreniere, Besser would not be supremely beneficial and paramount to long-term success of the franchise. It is very easy to make the argument of how could you refuse the idea of having this trio? Look how wonderful it would be. It's very tangible. It's something you can easily visualize and you clutch onto it. And it's very obvious progress. Elite players playing together bring sustained success. It's the bag of money. How on earth could you deny it? Would you really rather ride public transit to your job and keep earning your way? All of that. And this debate is really about progress. And it occurred to me yesterday, what's best for the franchise moving forward? How can they continue to progress? Both sides are in spirit making the same point. They're just looking for different avenues to explore that progress. And it occurred to me that the other side doesn't really have that type of argument where you can tangibly see it, because the delayed path to progress isn't remotely visual, right? It can be discussed, and Elias Pettersson discussed a bit of it yesterday, but it's not easy at all to see. It's exactly what I was talking about. It's the daily grind of going through it. Are you prepared to live through it? Here's a clip from Elias Pettersson that we talked about yesterday on the program when he met with media yesterday. And this is, it's tough to see, but this is the other side of that conversation.
And then first season was very good. I think at the end of the last 20, 30 games, my first season wasn't that good, but it was a good learning point for me. And my second season, I'm very happy with, but I still think, I know I can play better. And that's what motivates me. Mature in a game, never lose a puck battle, never lose if I'm going to try to dangle someone. It's like all like small areas, small details that I want to work on to become better.
That's Elias Pettersson reflecting on his first season, what he improved on in the second season, and how he can improve coming into the playoffs this upcoming play-in round. That is money earned. Like, that's getting up at 5:30 every morning, getting the kids ready for school, going off to work for another day. That's boring, but that's progress. Like, that's what progress looks like for those who want the playoffs. That's how growth occurs, because you go through the difficulty of the playoffs. That's a player focusing on detail. So if you want to make the argument of going through the longer path, that's what it looks like. That's the tangible version of what it looks like. And it's hard to relate to that. It's hard to be introspective and say, I need to improve this, 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 and this, and actually go about executing it, because it comes with its own pitfalls. It's not relatable, because we don't always try to look inward and say, hey, these are all the things I actually want to improve. And in 4 or 5 years' time, you don't look back and say, oh, hey, I did actually accomplish that. So both sides in this whole conversation have their merits. It just one side is significantly easier to relate to.
So, all of that is very well said. And I think you make a good point about, you know, how easy it is to dream on things with a very slim chance of happening. Like, who hasn't sat and daydreamed, you know, like you said, on the bus or at your office or on your lunch break about what it would be like to wake up tomorrow with, you know, X millions in the bank account and how that would change.
And we do the mailbag every day of the program. We get that question at least once a week.
For sure.
It's like, what are the first things you do with $40,000? What are the things you do with $18 million, whatever it is?
And of course, like, that's so natural. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, as long as you don't become obsessed with it, you don't let it distract you. Like, that's just totally natural. That's fine. You know, I think with this conversation, there's the fan perspective and there's the team perspective. And for fans that are saying, you know, I would prefer it, and I think it would be better if the team lost to Minnesota so that they had a chance at the first overall pick. You know, that's kind of a subjective thing. That's individual to each fan. I don't necessarily agree with that. That's not where I'm at right now as a fan, but I can understand that. I think the divide is when fans or other people start to argue that that's what the team should think, and the team should take steps towards making that happen. That is, I think, obviously wrong, right? The idea that the team actively trying to lose this play-in in order to give themselves a better shot at first overall, the idea that that would help them get farther on the road to the Stanley Cup, I think is clearly, clearly wrong. So I understand the daydreaming and saying, actually, it would be pretty nice to have this shot. That's fine. I get that. But there's no way it makes sense for the team to put that into action, because all of these cliches we talk about and the losing culture and things like that, you know, those would actually be a reality if you ever took concrete steps to lose what's basically a playoff series on purpose. That to me is just a bold line that cannot be crossed if you're trying to build a winning team here in Vancouver. So yeah, like you said, both sides have some merits, and it would be foolish to deny that a chance at Alexis Lafreniere is a very good thing. Of course it is. You'd be very happy to have that chance. It's just, what is the implication of that? And the implication cannot be that the Canucks themselves should go into this series with the aim of losing. Like, obviously, that would be a total disaster.
I feel like the tankists need just a better marketer. Right, because there's a difference between tanking and naturally losing, right? A lot of teams have had successful rebuilds when they've naturally lost. And
exactly.
Just and because they've drafted high doesn't mean it's like, oh, that's the only way to do it, so we should accelerate the process to do that.
And I've been very open about, if the Canucks lose, hey, it's a great consolation prize. An awesome consolation prize. Of course it is, but it's just, you said it well, like, you cannot go that way intentionally. As a fan, like I said, if you're like, hey, I know the team is going out there trying to win, but I personally will think it will be, you know, better in the long term if they lose. Again, I get that. I'm not sure I agree. That's not what I'm rooting for. It's the people who seem to think that, and this is not me making this up. Like, I've seen this argument out there that actually team would be smarter to.
We get the texts all the time. Yeah. 650, 650, which, by the way, chime in throughout the conversation here.
And then the other thing I'll say, just to your point and to your kind of opening statement off the top of the show, it's a good distinction between kind of, you know, the artificial booster getting to where you want to go of winning the first overall pick versus the day in, day out work. I will say the two aren't mutually exclusive, right? You know, if the Canucks lose to Minnesota and get lucky, win the lottery, draft Alexis Lafreniere, they still have to do all those other steps. They still have to put in the work day in, day out. Elias Pettersson, Brock Besser, Quinn Hughes, Bo Horvat, they still have to grow a lot of as players. And obviously Alexis Lafreniere does as well. So maybe that's another thing that the so-called tankists are missing, that, you know, it's not as if, oh, you lose this play-in series, you draft Alexis Lafreniere, and boom, you're a Stanley Cup contender. There's still a long, long way you have to go, even with that extra piece in place.
Yeah, that's fair. And it's just another element to this. And look, the other part of this is, like, we're talking about a chance, right? In my scenario, I gifted Lafreniere to the Canucks here, right?
Yeah.
We're ultimately talking about a chance. And look, that's lottery. I understand lotteries are significantly less likely than 12.5%.
Yeah, for sure. Everyone would, I would love to play that lottery.
Oh, yeah. My goodness. I'd buy 8 tickets and I feel great.
Yeah.
But it's mired in that issue of, you've got this murky middle that we're talking about a chance at doing things, right? And that's where it gets complicated. And it's a good point of, like, teams don't approach it as such, and it's a bit divorced from reality at times. Your thoughts? 650 650. This one's from Alistair from Clearwater, not Florida. My hope is less lose and get Lafreniere, and more lose and draft a talent that can fill a big organizational hole that can supplement our core and make us more relevant in the long term. That's a very niche tagline, but interesting thought from Alistair. Continuing on with this text here, is depth breeds success, and depth is more most easily achieved through good drafting. And in a draft as stacked as this, a good draft would be more beneficial than a playoff appearance. That's from Alistair from Clearwater, not Florida, to our 650-650 text line.
Yeah, first of all, I don't know if the lose for whatever it was he said their hashtag is going to, I'm not sure that hashtag is going to take off on Twitter, but I understand the point. And yeah, like, again, it's not wrong that drafting an awesome player is good for your team. Of course it is, but you can't just value that to the exclusion of everything else. And I understand, you know, there's such a tangible benefit when you get a really high draft pick, or even if you hit on, you know, someone in the middle rounds or a late first rounder like Brock Besser, that has such a clear tangible benefit because they come into your lineup, they produce, and they're making a minuscule cap hit. And it's really easy to measure how good that is for your team. And it's great for your team. We talk about it all the time, the importance of having star players on ELCs, right? So I understand that, because there's no debate about it, really. It's just, you look at it and you say, that is awesome for our team. The value of playoff experience is so much harder to measure, and it's so much harder to confirm.
It's exactly what I was talking about. It's incremental progress, right? Of, okay, Elias Pettersson got 2% better. Oh, JT Miller got 1% better. Quinn Hughes, 4% better. Like, collectively, that looks good. But we don't always frame it like that, right? Of, thank God they had this run, and now everyone's gotten better because they all just got a little bit better. No, like, the following year would say, wow, JT Miller has improved so much, and we talk about JT Miller. It never gets framed on the idea of collectively they've worked together because they've had to go through a tougher path.
And the nature of development is, you can never point to one factor and say, that's why this player turned the corner. We hear stories and, you know, we hear reporting about, okay, this player decided to work on thing X, or this player got a great tip from their coach and that really helped them, but we never really know. And I think that's where some people, and I'll count myself among this, like, I've been skeptical of the idea of playoff experience in the past, and I'm still probably not the biggest believer in the idea, because, again, it's, you can never prove that, you know, winning a playoff series in a player's rookie year is what put them on the road to success. You don't know what would have happened if they hadn't won that. So you can never actually prove it, but that doesn't mean it doesn't have value. It does have value. And I think there's a tendency to say, because it's unfalsifiable, because it's nebulous, it's intangible, that it doesn't exist. It does exist. I'll admit it can be frustrating and it can be maybe a little nerve-wracking to pass up a very tangible benefit in the hopes of an intangible benefit, but it's a mistake to act like it doesn't exist because it does exist.
Dell from Surrey, 650-650. Thing is, fans can dream weird dreams. Players don't even think about that. Yep. That's also true. Unsigned text here. Is getting the first overall pick really what we want? We all know. Given the chance, if Benning had the choice between Lafreniere and Byfield, he would go off the board and pick a used jock. All right. Interesting text. It's a 650-650 text.
I guess that one in. Wasn't what that one wasn't pre-screened by you.
No, I knew it. It was I knew what I was saying.
Well, and also, hold on. Before we go, there's a lot of criticisms you can levy at Jim Benning. I'm not sure, you know, avoiding talented players in the top 10 of the draft is one of them. Like, that seems like a weird criticism to hit Jim Benning with.
Especially, look, when you consider the two picks that people look at the fastest are Jake Vertanen and Ilya Levy, right? In their drafts, it's not as if those were quote-unquote reaches.
Those weren't off the board.
People were skeptical those would work out, but consensus, they were in that right range.
Yeah.
They just didn't work out.
Now, you could argue with that consensus, and I know, you know, certainly in the case of Jake Vertanen, I did, and a lot of other people did, and that's fair. But, it wasn't like he pulled some name out of a hat that nobody thought was going to go there. Those were very, very consensus picks.
The pizza guy. I want playoffs. I need to see playoff Jake. He's built for the playoffs. Built like a truck. I want to see him truck people up. Obviously, he's been a conversation this week also. Let's get to Scott New West, 650-650. The draft is still an imperfect science, even if you get first overall. Alexander Digg, Wickenheiser, Yakupov, obviously some famous flops over at first overall. It seems, though, that considering the way it seems harder to project busts in today's age, though.
Yeah, it does seem like it happens less often. At the same time, I mean, we're not that far removed from, you know, Nal Yakupov. Like,
that's also like a historically bad draft, though, too.
Yeah, you're right. That whole draft was trash. But you never want to say, oh, this guy's a sure thing, because you never know. But he's not going to be Alexander Daigle, right? Like, that would be a very, very, very surprising outcome. So I get that argument, but I don't think that if you're trying to, you know, win a debate against the tankers here, I'm not sure downplaying Lafreniere's upside is the way to go, because really, I think the hype is real there.
Really, since 2001. Okay, like, let's just remove Yakupov, right? Of the first overall picks. There's basically just been effective players. We can debate if they were the best player in that draft for sure. Like, Eric Johnson wouldn't go first of all in a redraft, but like all these players, Kovalchuk, Nash, Fleury, Ovechkin, Crosby, Eric Johnson, Kane, Stamkos, Tavares, Hall, Nugent Hopkins, McKinnon, Ekblad, McDavid, Matthews, Hischier, Dahlin, Jack Hughes. Let's take away the last 3 years because it's still
because we don't know.
It's still young. But like, those are effective players all the way through. So
yeah, those are all like
adding much
building blocks of your team style players, pretty much. Yeah.
Let's get to a couple more texts. Unsigned. Yule Levy was a huge stretch. Most people were like, who? I don't recall that at all. That's not my memory of the 2016 draft.
Well, here's the thing. There was people wanted Matthew Tkachuk, but that doesn't mean
people also wanted Svechkov as well.
Yeah. Yeah. That doesn't mean like Ylevi was projected to go in that range. There's a difference between a reach and a bad pick. You know what I mean? Ylevi turns out to be who have been the wrong pick, but he wasn't projected to go, you know, 25th. He was projected to go between 5 and 10, and that's where he went.
I want to say he was like the number 5 or 6 North American skater that year for Central Scouting. So, because I remember Chychrun was higher than him, and Matt Tkachuk was obviously higher than him. So a lot of people wanted him, but obviously Laine, Puljujarvi, Matthews were all higher, but it was in that range. So it was a bad pick, just wasn't a reach. 650-650, another unsigned text. I'm all in on seeing the Canucks beating the Wild and going on a deep run. I can never cheer for them to lose. Mind you, if they lose while playing hard, I won't be as mad as I normally would be due to having a decent chance of finally winning first overall pick. It'll be, oh, it's from James. It'll be typical Canucks luck to have a pandemic help us get our first overall pick. Yeah, again, and that's the difference between losing naturally.
So just, again, the texter chiming in with you, Levy. So Sam Cosentino, Sportsnet's hockey, junior hockey draft guru, had Olia Levy ranked 6th overall going into the 2016 draft. So if you're saying because he was ranked 6th in some sources that it was a reach at 5, that's just not really how the draft works. You know, there's not that level of definition after you get past the first like 1, 2, or 3 spots. So if you're consensus ranked in the 5 to 10 area and you go at 5, it's just not a reach, not how the draft works.
650, appreciate all the interaction. We'll try to get to a couple of more texts later on in the show here. I should mention, obviously, we value your interaction here on Social Distance Central. Today is Game of Takes. We pushed everything a day, so we're going to air the takes today from our composite champion, Ty Party at T Party 21. The competitor will be Nick. So we'll air their takes of who the Canucks MVP was coming up in about 20, 25 minutes. We'll do that. And we'll get to a couple more of your action as well. So Game of Takes continues today. You'll have all weekend to vote at Sportsnet 650 on Twitter. So we'll find out who the next week for the who will sit upon the composite throne in Game of Takes. So that's coming up in just a bit here. Should we get to a couple more texts here, Jamie?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Terry and Burnaby, I abhor the idea of tanking to win. Edmonton, the poster child for this concept, and what did that get them? Look at all the playoff experience. The Oilers benefit as a result. LOL, losing begets losing.
Yeah, the Oilers one is interesting because that's a very fair criticism, which Terry and Burnaby levies there. And first of all, great word on abhor, Terry. I love that.
Yeah, but I really had to lean into that one.
It was good. But it's also, I mean, I feel almost dumb saying this because they won the lottery so many times in a row, but they also kind of got unlucky within that because, like you said, one of them was, Nally Yakupov. Another one was Nugent Hopkins. Great player, but not, you know, of the last 20 years of first overall picks, he's not in the top half of that list. So I don't know. Edmonton just seems like such a unique case, and we know about the mismanagement and everything. I'm not sure you can use Edmonton to prove your point either way. Really, like, it just seems like such a weird anomaly. Everything that happened there was weird. I don't know what to make of it overall.
A lot of text coming in now. Well, if Yule Levy was ranked 6th, of course he wasn't a reach. So to the previous Yule Levy texter, you got a lot of detractors in our 650.
And again, I just want to say, I'm not saying it was like the right pick or that Matthew Tkachuk, even at the time, without hindsight, wouldn't have been a better pick. I think I would have preferred Tkachuk at the time. It's just, you can't say he went off the board with his crazy pick. That's just not what happened.
It just didn't work out. Yeah. 650. This one's from Joey in Richmond. Hindsight, 2020. Easy to say a good draft is more valuable than playoff experience. What if we do win the cup or even make the finals? I'd rather have a 6% chance at a cup than a 12% chance at a draft pick personally. I like our core. I think a taste of winning would be perfect appetizer for Petey, Quinn, and the boys. Just can't get behind wanting to lose after living through that game 7 in the finals. We need that win here. I think the true odds, I think the Vegas currently has the Canucks at 35-1. So that's about just shy of 3%, I believe. So that's what we're talking about. Yep. When it comes to the Canucks Stanley Cup chances. The thing I would say, though, the better way to look at it to me is you have a 50-50 chance basically versus the Minnesota Wild, right? I think they've got a 54% chance of winning according to the Vegas odds.
I mean, it's a coin flip, really, realistically.
So that presents you another opportunity to basically have another coin flip.
And, you know,
I think that's the better way to look at it.
Yeah, I agree. I was talking about this earlier in the week, and I think Joey in Richmond kind of hits on it here. You know, as a fan, even putting aside the debate about what would be best for the team, and I think there is at least somewhat of a debate there, like, I want to see the Canucks play playoff hockey for as long as possible this year. That's what I want to see. I mean, with everything else going on in the world, that would be great. That would be really, really, really fun right now. So I think we kind of lose sight of that too. Like, why are we fans? It's because we like watching these guys compete in important games. We have that opportunity right now. And not only do I think it would help them in the long run, but just for me personally, it would be great to have that in my life right now.
All right, we're going to get to Game of Takes coming up. Also, Brian Burke was talking about the Louis Erickson potential buyout scenario. We'll touch on that. Plus, Red Navarre joined us on the program yesterday, just kind of outlining the economic reality for these players as we get ready for a return to play. And, you know, while we're waiting for a CBA confirmation and all that, it was really informative. You can listen to the whole thing on the program page at sportsnet.ca/650. I wanted to highlight a bit of it just so we're all aware of the realities that everyone was facing. That's all coming up here on Social Distance Central. Plus, your reaction, 650, keep it coming in. It's Bick Nizar, Jamie Dodd on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. Social Distance Central, Bick Nizar, Jamie Dodd, home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. A lot of texts coming in. We'll try to get to a couple of them. It's been a varied conversation. A lot of people talking about the Olli Juolevi pick and also just what we were talking about. And the idea that, you know, winning the lottery, obviously it's fantastic if the Vancouver Canucks got Alex Lafreniere. But I was making the point, like, the conversation is very much how we relate to money won versus we don't really relate to money earned, because it's much tougher to try to go through the grind of getting better internally, as Elias Pettersson was talking about, some things that he wanted to improve on and he intends to improve on. And it's the collective of getting better. So keep the thoughts coming in, 650. Also going to get to Game of Takes coming up in about 10 to 15 minutes as Tea Party 21 at Tea Party 21. Ty Party tries to defend his title when talking about the Canucks MVP. But Louis Erickson, once again, Jamie, has been a topic of discussion today.
Oh, yeah. And unfortunately, what we are learning about the, or at least unfortunately from a Canucks fans perspective, what we're learning about the, you know, new return to play CBA mega deal that's coming down the pike here is that there will not be compliance buyouts included in it in all likelihood. However, that, you know, still people are still talking about, because the cap is going to be flat, what does that mean for teams like the Canucks that are already in some salary cap trouble if they don't have, you know, at least a little bit of breathing space given to them by the cap rising? Brian Burke was on in Toronto this morning, and he was talking that he thinks we'll see not compliance buyouts, but just regular old buyouts. He thinks we'll see a lot more of those, and he mentioned one particular Canuck that could be a candidate for that.
I think you're going to see teams that are reluctant to buy out big contracts like Louis Erickson. They may just not have a choice. You don't get much cap relief, but you get enough in this situation where every little centimeter of wiggle room is important. So that's a note I made, is offer sheets and buyouts. And I think Gord's right. I think you're going to have teams with no chance to match, and you could get a pretty good player for draft pick compensation. Remember, there's draft pick compensation on the offer sheets, but it's not severe. It's poorly pegged. It's severe at the highest level. It's not severe enough at the lowest level, and there's a middle ground there where you can steal a guy cheaply. So, yeah, I agree with Gord. But I also think you'll see some buyouts. So I don't have Louis Erickson's contract in front of me. I think he's got 2 years left at six. A lot of it's signing bonus. I think the cash value is four. And you'd ordinarily say, well, we're not going to bother buying that out. We don't get meaningful cap savings. But I think you're going to see teams look at it now and say, we got no choice. Maybe it only picks us up $500,000 in the cap room, but we need that $500,000.
So that's Brian Burke talking about the potential for buyouts after a new flat cap comes in for the foreseeable future. And, you know, he was speculating, and he wasn't far off on what exactly a Louis Erickson buyout would look like. And it's the kind of thing, you know, for so long, the conversation here in Vancouver has been, listen, it doesn't make any sense to buy Louis Erickson out because the cap savings you get from it are so minor. Now, with the caveat that the dates, the NHL calendar is all screwed up, and we know that when you buy someone out has an effect on what the cap hit would be. But if this was a normal year and they bought him out this summer, It would only be a savings of $333,000 in cap next year, which is almost nothing. So you can understand why that's not an appealing option. Mm-hmm. But the year after that, it would be a saving of $2.3 million. So from that perspective, if you say, okay, we don't get anything out of it this year, but we know the salary cap is still going to be flat next year, we need those $2.3 million because we're so up against it. And that's also when we're going to be trying to re-sign Quinn Hughes and Elias Pettersson to new deals. When you start to look at it from that perspective, I think Brian Burke is onto something here. And I think we should be getting ready for the likelihood of a Louis Eriksson buyout.
Again, the term I've been using is like a natural resolution, right? And
yeah,
and this could be one. I still feel like, you know, doing the whole send him to the AHL and see what happens kind of scenario could also play out, because you still leave yourself the opportunity to buy out in the future. It feels like that would be kind of jumping ahead a little bit if you wanted to buy him out immediately. Right.
Yeah,
I get the logic. It makes sense. It just feels like that's a final way to go about it. You could, and look, I know this sucks, especially for Louis Eriksson, but like, you could make it tougher on Louis Eriksson to allow him to make the decision for you.
That's the ideal, right? And yes. I know some people have scoffed at, oh, he's not going to walk away from whatever X million remaining. Well, people do that. People have done that. And if it's more appealing than, you know, like, it's funny because we're all saying, oh, he's going to ride the bus in the American Hockey League. But we have no idea what's going to go on in the American Hockey League.
Is there even going to be
exactly
an American Hockey, right?
Is it going to be even like a weirder and less pleasant version to play in? Are you going to be playing in front of empty buildings? Are you going to be like, what kind of weird protocols are you going to have to go through to play in it? It could be way less appealing even than it normally is for someone like Louis Eriksson. We have no idea. So that outcome that you're talking about is still very, very much on the table. If it doesn't happen, then I agree. Then you go to the buyout, because I think one way or the other, you need some savings off of this deal when Elias Pettersson and Quinn Hughes are up for new deals.
It is an avenue that they can explore. I still think that there's a way that this gets solved before the finality of a buyout. And look, if Louis Eriksson digs his heels in and he says, no, I'm going to call your bluff and I'm going to go to the AHL and it's only $1 million cap savings for you, let's see how this plays out, then, man, kudos to him. And then you can start exploring the idea of a buyout, because look, it is right. The longer this drags on, it is technically more feasible for the Vancouver Canucks to buy him out. Because if they wait a year, if I'm not mistaken, it's only like $1 million cap hit for the extra bonus year for the 2022-23 season. So the longer you push this back, the easier it becomes to just write the check and move on.
Although the flip side of that is, if you wait a year, your savings for that last year are actually less than if you bought him out this year. So if you wait a year and buy him out, you're only saving $2 million, which is not a big deal. You know, it's two versus $2.3 million, but it is saving slightly less than if you bought him up this summer. So that, and it sounds ridiculous to be talking about, you know, oh, a $0.3 million difference in cap space. But I mean, that's the world we're entering, not just the Canucks, but everyone in the NHL, as things get really, really tight here, where you do have to be concerned about margins that thin.
It's Bick Nizar and Jamie Dodd. You can keep the comments coming in. 650, 650. We were just talking about the idea of, you know, the whole the lottery and tanking as well. This one from, actually, it's unsigned text. Edmonton's won one playoff series with all of their lottery picks. If the Canucks win a few series, it will show that tanking isn't always the answer. However, Benning drafting Vertanen and Ulevi did set this team back a couple of years. We're absolutely conceding that point. We're just talking about where they were drafted. Were they big reaches? And they just weren't. They were just bad picks, and that happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. I mean, it did set the team back a couple of years. I don't think there's any argument about that. You go through the classic exercise of, oh, they could have had player X instead, and yeah, the team would have been farther ahead a few years ago. This comes in from James. He says, Jim Benning picked Olli Ylevi because they were concentrating on rebuilding the defense at the time. Personally, I'm glad they took him. It's unfortunate he's been plagued with injuries. Hopefully, he's got them behind him and become a top 4D. That's from James. Yeah, and I mean, that's another interesting kind of philosophical discussion. I personally, like, it's a mistake to be to say in a top with a top five pick, oh, we need to rebuild our defense, so we're going to take Olajuwon. I'm not sure that's exactly what Jim Benning's thought process was, but it's a great illustration of why you go best player available, especially that high in the draft.
Keep the comments coming in, 650, 650. We'll get to Game of Takes in just a moment. Did want to play this back from Ren Lavoie, because we're talking about the return-to-play scenario, and so much is at hand. And actually, while we're talking about that Lou Eriksson buyout in a scenario where there's a flat cap, this is what the pressures actually look like for the players. And you and I, Jamie, talked to Eric Engels on Tuesday, the idea of, you know, players hadn't heard a lot about the safety protocols. A lot of what they've been told so far is about the financial implications of if they do or don't come back. And as this evolves and we're getting more concrete information because we're approaching a deadline, right? It's no longer speculative of what it looks like. We're getting more concrete figures as well. I want to play this back from Ren Lavoie, just talking about what the realities are for the players right now.
The players, it's going to be their call. If I was them, though, knowing what I know, I'll obviously sign this CBA extension. And the reason why is quite simple. Nobody's going to put a gun to the players to be back, obviously, to play. But if you look at the alternative is a $66 million cap for next season. Escrow will be between 50 and 75%. That's the reality for the players. If they're coming back, if they sign that CBA, they'll probably get 75% of the revenues for next season. So, to be honest with you, I look at it from the outside and I'm like, the owners really wants to have hockey back and they really love the game to offer a deal that could give close to 75% of hockey revenues next season to the players. It's unique. Obviously, it's going to be painful for the players too. They'll have to give some money back. But I believe that it's going to be way better for them to sign the new CBA when it's going to be presented to them.
So $66 million there for a potential cap, right? And by the way, when we went into great detail with Ren yesterday, so if you want some more, jump online at sportsnet.ca/650, and it's on the program. He does a great job of illustrating just kind of the difficulties these players are facing. So $66 million, just in relation to the cap, like, to give you an idea of how far this sets the league back, the cap in the 13-14 season was 64.3, then a jump up to $69 million in 14-15. So you're kind of setting the league back 6-7 years as far as a cap's perspective if you don't choose to go ahead with this. And then it brings in all those questions that we're talking about, Jamie, with buyouts and all that. And so this is what these players are facing with this decision of, yeah, you may not want to come back into these circumstances, but the point we've been harboring, the harping on these past couple of days is this looks like it's the best of a series of bad options.
Yeah, and what we've heard from the players, I think, kind of echoes what you're saying, where there's a lot of discontent, there's a lot of grumbling, there's a lot of saying, listen, I would prefer not to play, but then what do they all end it with? But we're probably going to play. We're going to vote to play for it, despite all of that, because we understand how important it is. And the number that really caught me there from Ren was not just the cap, which is crazy, but the 50 to 75% escrow. Like that is the nightmare scenario for players, right? Where you're just getting a huge, like the majority, a significant majority of your salary clawed back every paycheck. And when you put it that way, and it's like, yeah, there is a lot that sucks for the players about this return to play plan, but I do think they also understand just how bad it would be for them individually and also for the league as a whole to forego all of this potential revenue.
Yeah, it'd be completely disastrous, right? And the one thing I should say, and Sat did a great job making this point yesterday, it's both sides here, because usually CBA negotiations, very contentious, right? It's we've been through multiple lockouts and both sides really dig their heels in. Both sides right now look like they're working together to find a real solution. And they're both amenable to the idea of, hey, we got to figure this out for the betterment of the sport and the business as a whole. Because if they don't, there are some stark realities that are facing them.
And it's these kinds of crises that spur people to get deals done and to get, you know, deals that in other times would have seemed impossible. And you saw, you know, you heard Ren mention it as well, like the percentage of revenue that the teams are willing to give to the players next year. We never would have heard something like that unless it was completely unprecedented time. So it does seem like, you know, despite the fact that negotiations are maybe dragging out a little more than we expected, something will get done. And I think that was a really good explanation from Ren Lavoie of, you know, despite all the misgivings, why the players will eventually agree to return.
It is Social Distance Central. Dick Nazar, Jamie Dodd here on Sportsnet 650, the home of the Canucks. You've been listening to this for a couple of weeks now. We love to do it. Last week's vote was so close. It was like 50.5% to 49.5%. It was razor thin last week because you voted at Sportsnet 650. We love doing this. It is Game of Takes. We give you a question.
When you play the Game of Takes,
winter is coming.
You either win.
A lion doesn't concern himself with the opinions of a sheep.
Or, well, you know.
Dracarys.
Rally the realm and make your claim to the composite throne. Here's Bick.
I drink and I know things.
And Batch.
You know nothing, Jon Snow.
Valar Morghulis.
We give you the question. You chime in. We pick the competitor. Big shout out to our champion sitting atop the composite throne. At Tea Party 21. So he's been the big winner so far. He is taking on this week Nick Dragon. You can follow him at Twitter as well. At Big Bambino 97. So they're going to take it off. And the question we posed this week was, who is the Canucks MVP? Who is your MVP this upcoming season? Because there's been a lot of good candidates this season, Jamie, and it's been a widely discussed topic throughout the course of the season. So we finally have our two takes. You and I shared our takes, so I'm curious how these two competitors will do theirs. We go to the competitor first. It's Nick Dragon.
The success of a young team is very dependent on a reliable goalie, which Markstrom is. But the reason why I chose him for MVP this year is not only his save percentage, but his ability to bail out our defense. His save percentage was .918, you know, very great, but his ability to bail out our defense was just best to none. 17 out of 43 games that he started this year, our defense gave up 35 shots on goal. You know, I'm not going to talk about every single one of those games, but one in particular against Chicago back in February, you know, we gave up 49 shots. We gave guys like Kane and Taves 49 opportunities to score a goal. He gave up zero goals. Praise our offense for scoring three goals on their 20 shots, but to be outshot by 30 shots almost and give up zero goals is almost unheard of. Out of those 17 games with 35 plus shots, Markstrom was able to win 13 out of those games. In my mind, is just absolutely crazy. You know, I'm not gonna take away the fact that our big three, you know, Horvat, Besser, and Pedersen, they all had career years, you know, so that's what made us a very hard choice.
Nick, going with Jacob Markstrom as the Canucks MVP. We're going to put these up on Twitter in just a moment at Sportsnet 650. But first, you got to hear from the champion, the leader, sitting atop of the composite throne. It's Ty at Tea Party 21. Who's his MVP?
When we talk about the MVP award, there's obviously a great debate on this Canucks roster. We've had tremendous seasons from the likes of JT Miller, Quinn Hughes, and Jacob Markstrom. However, when it comes to the MVP, the season that Elias Pettersson just put together is not getting enough credit. I know the main argument against Pettersson is obviously Jacob Markstrom, and I'll do everything I can to compare goalie versus skater. The best way we can do this is to use wins above replacement. That'll show us how many wins a player was worth over a replacement level player. Just for context, wins by replacement rankings on the Canucks. Pettersson, 4.2, Hughes, 2.1, Markstrom, 2.1, and Miller, 1.9. Moving on with Pettersson, he grades out as a first-line center in every aspect of the game. Even if we single out his defensive play, he still qualifies as a first-line player. And obviously his offense speaks for itself. But looking at his defense is really an underrated part of his game. As I mentioned earlier with the rankings, Pettersson had 4.2 wins by replacement. That would equate to a total of 26.8% of the Canucks' total wins this season. That is third in all of hockey for context too. When we look at Markstrom, there is a lot of private data that will work in his favor. I unfortunately don't work in the NHL and I don't have access to it. So I'll use the public data, which is still very predictive of a player's value. So using goals saved above expected, which takes into account the probability of a goal being scored and how many of those saves a goalie made, Markstrom ranks 11th on most models and 10th on a few. Many will argue that wins by replacement won't be as high as a goalie because of the goals and assists and points, which may be worth more. And I still got news for you if that you think that's the case though. Connor Hellebuyck ranked 4.8 wins by replacement this season. That's higher than anybody else in the entire league. It's not a question goalie can rank high in wins by replacement at all. In the end, this is really no knock on Markstrom or JT Miller or Quinn Hughes. It's more of a sign of how good Elias Pettersson is and just how lucky we are as fans to have him. At the end of the day, I'll ask you this one question. If you can keep one player on this team, who is it? It's Elias Pettersson, and that's because he's the MVP.
The champion speaks from atop the composite throne. Elias Pettersson is his MVP. Jamie, you and I made the debate this week. I talked about in relation to, you know, Elias Pettersson's obviously been the best player, but in relation to impact on wins, for me, it's been Jacob Markstrom. You felt the other way.
Yeah, I went with Elias Pettersson. I'm going to ride with the champ, Ty. You know, I you got to be on the winning side, right? So you got to stick up for the champion. But no, I understand the arguments for Jacob Markstrom, and they're strong arguments. And again, this is one of those things where it's really fun to debate, but I'm not going to like yell at anyone for choosing the other way because they're both really good candidates.
Mm-hmm.
My MVP rationale is always like default to the best player. If the best player had a really good season, that's probably your MVP. And this one is close. Markstrom did a lot to overcome that, but it's just the total package from Elias Pettersson. It's the points. It's the defensive value. It's the play driving, the power play prowess. It's everything about it. And I just think about what a gap it would be in their top six if they lost him. For me, that he just edges it out over Jacob Markstrom.
You have your chance to cast your vote. We're just posting the videos up online. If you want to re-listen to them, jump up to Twitter at Sportsnet650 and cast your vote to win. I'll be back later on today with Sat Shah on the program. But Jamie, you stick around with Randeep Janda. It is Friday, so we're going to hear from NHL insider Dave Pignota on the way on Reach Deep on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.